Good morning and welcome to the Daily Connection here on KDOV. Pat Daly with you at 5 and a half minutes after 10 o'clock on a Thursday, not just any old Thursday. It's the Thursday before Christmas. And you know what happens at the end of the month on Thursdays? Well, I get a couple of my favorite guys in. That's Matt McAuliffe and Chris White. And today, we're going to be talking about Christmas without Chris. You know, Matt, it's you and me, bud.
Now think of that. Christmas without Chris.
Huh.
Wow.
That's close, but
the theological implications alone are staggering.
Yes, Christmas without Chris. And Christine isn't here either. So. But anyway, we're going to talk about Christmas today.
Yay, man.
And just how it came to be such a wonderful holiday, you know?
It has really grown all sorts of little appendages culturally and traditionally. It's really interesting, Pat. In studying for this, the early Christians really didn't hardly celebrate the Nativity at all. In the first century or two of the church, I guess they were... the imminent return of Christ was so expected that they just didn't bother. They just thought he was coming back very, very quickly. And then there were the persecutions and being thrown to the lions to deal with things, so they really didn't have an opportunity to develop a lot of tradition. But about midway through the second century, one of the bishops of Rome, before they were really called popes, decided, you know, we really need to be celebrating the Nativity. Mm-hmm. And no one had any idea, could remember when the Lord was born. And so they kind of ended up in the September neighborhood sort of having a feast. And it wasn't until Constantine in 300 or 311 came to power, and the Byzantine Empire was born, and he's the one that actually, under his administration, things really started picking up. That's when they decided that the church designated December 25th as Christmas, even though when we read Luke, obviously the birth happens sometime in the spring when the lambs are out there.
The shepherds are in the field doing that. Yeah, it would have been...
But here's the political upside was, because of the Saturnalia, the Roman festival, and the winter equinox, they were able to co-opt that winter festival and really use the celebratory infrastructure already in place, you know, the feasting and gaming and everything, and they were just able to co-opt that, stamp it as Christmas, and call it a Christian function, and it worked. It worked really well. Christmas, December 25th became Christmas, and it was feasting and gift exchanging, and that by pointing out the example of the Magi giving gifts to the Christ mm-hmm. child. Now, at first, I have to say, they did try to discourage decorating with greenery, because that was so closely associated with pagan practices, but it was hopeless.
That was probably one of those Gothic European Indo-European things.
Everybody. As a matter of fact, we'll talk about that in a minute with the Christmas tree. That, Egypt, China.
But they were all doing the greener.
Oh, right? You name it, you know, gracious. Well, I mean, if you think about it, the coniferous, the pine trees, the fir trees, gosh, mm-hmm. they're beautiful, they're tough, they're long-lasting. You know, what better symbol, no matter what movement or concept you're trying to espouse, what better symbol for long-lasting beauty and truth? So, yeah, that was kind of sucked in there. It was a no-brainer. Well, it's interesting because around this time as well is when we see a good old friend evolve on the southern coast of what is now Turkey. Oh. And it's a guy by the name of Saint Nicholas. And he's just he was orphaned early, born to a middle-aged family, became a monk, and eventually grew spiritually adept enough that people recognized his reputation. He was made a bishop mm-hmm. and was actually persecuted by Diocletian in the last days of the pagan Roman Empire. Well, he finally came to be the bishop there on the southern coast and had such a reputation for his generosity, his care of children, the poor. I mean, it's said he threw bags of money down chimneys to the poor widows so they wouldn't know where it came from, thus giving mm-hmm. birth to the down the chimney
thing. I've heard that one just inside the window,
mm-hmm.
too.
Oh, inside the window. That's the fun thing. You know, you go back and you look at these legends, you know, you look at all the barnacles that have clustered around each one of these figures, and you can just pick and choose whatever you want. I mean, one minute, Joseph and Mary and Jesus are fleeing the Pharaoh's troops, and they hide in a holly tree to escape them. In the next one, it's a pine tree. Uh-huh. In the next one, it's a mistletoe. So, although the mistletoe did get a bad rap, supposedly mistletoe was the was the wood out of which the cross was fashioned. And so mistletoe is really on the politically incorrect list. Yeah, we wanted to replace that with holly as quickly as we possibly could. And
never did.
Never really did. I mean, it was just as pagan as the mistletoe, but that's okay. You know what, like I say, what God has cleansed, let no man call unclean.
Well, anyway, you're on the south coast of Turkey with St. Nick.
Well, basically, St. Nick just lived a good life, bless his soul, and he did a lot of good things. And here's what turned him into such a cultural icon is around the turn of the millennium, some Italian sailors stole into Myra, which is the little town where he was. It's just a ruin now. They stole his body, dug him up, exhumed his bones, and took them to Bari, which is a coastal town on the heel of the Italian boot.
Yeah.
And this became a real pilgrimage site because they had St. Nicholas's bones, and really increased his popularity in Europe. And before long, I mean, all of Northern Europe has a St. Nicholas-type figure. He becomes Kris Kringle. Once the Reformation happens, they even wanted to get away from the Catholic saint thing, so they started calling him Father Christmas, Kris Kringle, Father Winter, and but bless the Dutch, you know, they called him Sinterklaas, and they were the ones that came over and colonized originally, so he came over to the United States as Sinterklaas, or St. Nick.
All right, so somehow we went from St. Nick to Sinter, or it's probably the saint part.
Yeah, it's you know, Flemish Dutch for saint.
Okay, and then Claus, we don't know where that came from necessarily, but anyway.
That was before the Santa Claus. Yeah. Sorry, never mind.
No. Santa Claus. It's like, no, we don't want the sanity clause.
Oh, no, okay. No. Well, it's interesting. You know, as a matter of fact, it wasn't later a lot of the Santa characteristics that we're familiar with developed. Not that the Middle Ages... Not that that's all they were worried about. I mean, that's where St. Francis, in around 1200, came up with the first nativity scene, built the first creche, which is just a French word for a manger. Mm-hmm. So he built the first nativity scene. Martin Luther, walking through the woods, saw how beautiful the stars were shining through the pine trees. He's the guy that actually lit on the idea of putting candles in the tree.
Wow.
And the Christmas tree itself had actually been around for a long time. As we said before, I mean, almost every culture in the world had some sort of greenery, some sort of pine tree up at a certain festival time. But around year 700, 800, Vikings running around, and Charlemagne is king of the Franks. By this time, the use of what is called a Christmas tree or a paradise tree is quite common throughout Northern Europe. And by paradise tree, it's... there's the old legend that it's the tree of life from the Garden of Eden, but because of the fall and the curse, its leaves and its fruit turned into needles and cones.
Huh.
Well, that's not very well documented, Pat.
It might not stand up in the botany class, but...
Absolutely. But nonetheless, a lot of folks were using it. It was a common practice to have one in your... on the German plains. It was common practice to have one in the living room or on the front steps. Anyone who was anyone had a paradise tree during the Christmas holidays.
So this was 7th, 8th, 9th centuries?
Yeah, 700s, 800s, okay. And just developed. I mean, pretty soon they were hanging wafers to represent the host of communion. They were hanging wafers and crackers on the tree, kind of probably the first decorations. It wasn't long before these turned into cookies. And by the time Martin Luther comes along during the 1500s and starts hanging candles on it, you're really, the German Christmas tree by that time had really become, in spite of its pagan origins, mm-hmm. a shining, highly decorated, really unique symbol of Christmas. And it was pretty spectacular.
So you had the host, it was the original decorations, they'd put wafers mm-hmm. on there, and then mm-hmm. that turned into cookies, and yeah, that's a good German thing. And and the lights, that was... the lights was Martin Luther, the stars mm-hmm. shining through the pine trees.
Well, a lot of people also don't know that caroling actually began in medieval times, in the 13th and 14th century. O Come, Emmanuel is a 12th century hymn, and a lot of them started because churchy music was just too stuffy. You know, it wasn't happy enough, and so they actually started writing songs specifically for Christmas. And, of course, this just took off when it reached England later, but that actually is one of the older ones. And, you know, another very interesting tradition that started in around the 1500s was the use of the term Xmas. you know, that we see now.
Right.
And I used to feel guilty about writing Xmas. I felt, you know, cheapening the Christmas thing. But the fact is, what that is the Greek letter chi, mm-hmm. and or the chi, and stands for, it's the first letter of Christos. And actually, the practice of using Xmas as a shorthand dates 500 years ago. And just because it has the same number of letters as sale, Christmas sale, I think that's why we see it so much in our newspapers.
Yes.
And we've gotten a little frumpy about using it. But don't feel bad. If you wanna use the shorthand in your letters, you have a fine Christian tradition to fall back on.
I was thinking about that, actually. I'm glad you brought that up, the X. I mean, I used to feel the same way, and then I thought, well, you know, having done the medieval thing and mm-hmm. going back to the Greek, wait a minute. You look at most of the time, you get that big X is for...
Well, it's a cross.
It's
yeah.
a cross, and it's Christ. So that was a symbol for Christ a long, long time.
We tend to get too worried too quickly, I think.
Don't we? Thank you. Boy, just relieved us of that burden. So Xmas is fine. Okay.
Well, now we've got kind of the Reformation happening, and all these wonderful, colorful traditions that have grown up in Northern Europe all of a sudden are associated with too much Catholic finery, you know, and so a lot of the Puritans, Oliver Cromwell, the Puritans, some of the Protestants really kind of start downplaying the festive, and they're just traumatized. They're mm-hmm. just traumatized by, you know, so many years of the organized church sort of selling the sizzle instead of the steak. And so they just get rid of all that stuff. And Christmas is a very quietly observed holiday. Especially when it first came over to America, it was a very quietly observed holiday. And it wasn't until the Victorian age, and roughly speaking, we're talking 1800s. Mm-hmm. Queen Victoria, I think, came to the English throne in 1837 and lasted till 1901. But for our purposes, the 1800s. You know, England is in the grip of the Industrial Age, the Industrial Revolution. You know, children, women, cripples are working in the mines and the factories 16, 18 hours a day. They're getting paid virtually nothing. Greed is running everything. It's just running rampant. And an amazing thing happens in the Victorian age. For some strange reason, and you may trace this back to the moving of the Spirit associated with the Great Awakening. Remember, Whitfield was preaching at this time. Wesley was preaching at this time. But the Spirit really started to move. And there were people called the Clapham sect, a bunch of wealthy Englishmen, mm-hmm. A guy named Wilberforce. All these guys got together and in the name of Christ really began lobbying for social reform. And it took off. It really did a good job. They ended up, Wilberforce almost single-handedly ended up banning slavery in right. the world. England was the first. And the Clapham sect, a lot of reforms in child labor laws and everything. Well, all of this was kind of the background. And surprisingly, as far as I can tell, the thing that touched this off was in 1834, Charles Dickens published A Christmas Carol. And it just went through the roof.
How
people, in the midst of all this cold, calculating greed, people just could not get enough of this. It even surprised him. He just dashed it off. He was actually
yeah, like
another,
written in a couple of days or something, wasn't it?
It was a throwaway. It was a nothing. But boy, it got printed, and people just went berserk. Within a couple of years, my gosh, there were carolers wandering around London all the time. Huge reforms were being made. It's like it really primed the spirit and the mind of the English people, especially the urban English people, for these huge reforms that were going on. I mean, it so clearly showed that things were bad. Things were really bad, and the only hope lay in love. Because it wasn't even necessarily a Christian story, but it so captured the spirit, the essential spirit that we associate with Christmas in terms of giving, sacrifice, all Christian characteristics, that by golly, it went from there. I mean, they were exchanging Christmas postcards within a couple years after that.
How about that?
And that was associated with the development of a postal system in England at that time. But now I think, my gosh, I think in America, each year we do at least 2 billion Christmas cards all by ourselves. That's quite the business. Hallmark is very happy with us.
Yeah, well, I'm sure that there are many beneficiaries through the commercial ads.
Well, you know, the Christmas tree was an interesting thing because Queen Victoria eventually married German Prince Albert.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came over, guess what he brought with him?
A Christmas tree, is that right? Well, there you go.
And Christmas trees had been in England before. He brought with him from his hometown was this beautifully decorated Christmas tree. Well, Queen Victoria just loved it and set several up in Buckingham, several in the palace, all over the place. Well, it became the rage, and it jumped the ocean and hit the United States, and everybody had a Christmas tree by then. As a matter of fact, the Victorian era probably provided us with most of the images and most of the traditions that we are aware of at this time, in terms of our own celebration of Christmas. Gosh, we get our stockings, I think, from that. You know, the caroling, the Christmas Eve celebration. A lot of those things come primarily from the Victorian era. And, you know, in all fairness, the Victorian era had a lot of problems. But the fact is, the people were motivated, allowed themselves to be motivated by the Spirit. Hopefully, I think we're going to do a program on this later. It's almost a unique period in human history.
The Clapham sect in England in the early part of the 1800s.
Yeah. Can't really think of another example of that much wonderful social change happening. And it was primarily the people praying, the awakening happening. It just, it was unique. Well, it did spill over into the United States. Like I say, up until about, oh gosh, the Civil War, Christmas wasn't really a big deal. Americans were still kind of recovering from being traumatized in the Reformation. And so they weren't really used to celebrating Christmas with a lot of foo-for-ah. However, an interesting thing happened during the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln commissioned Thomas Nast, the political cartoonist and artist that most of us have heard about, and asked him to put a series of paintings in the Harper Weekly, the magazine that really was the CNN of its day. And so he did, and he put a series of Christmas paintings in there. This is where we get our picture of Santa checking his naughty and nice list, answering the letters of the children. This is where the idea of Santa's workshop and the elves comes from.
So this was at Abraham Lincoln's behest?
Yeah, this was in the 1860s at Abraham Lincoln's behest.
Okay.
Now, he did an interesting thing, too. He asked Thomas Nast to picture Santa in the midst of the Northern soldiers, the Union soldiers.
Oh.
And it's interesting that how many historians have commented this really depressed the Confederate soldiers. They were really bummed when they got their copies of Harper's Weekly and said, Santa's with them. What a bummer. Well, it's just funny. You know, God, love them. Well, from that point, really, Christmas, the traditions began really jumping on board quickly. Christmas was celebrated more and more. Alabama actually was the first state to make it a holiday in 1836, but it wasn't long till all the states really did, and it became a big deal. Even today, we've still got, my gosh, Miracle on 34th Street, Norman Rockwell Santa series. Oh, gosh, what's the Jimmy Stewart? It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah.
So there's
Christmas Carol has four or five versions. Oh, I like Alistair Sims the best.
No, I like George C. Scott. Goodness. But you can see that stuff is really, it's still alive. It's still going, even though, truthfully, we have, what did I just read the other day? I think in Washington Post. Santa Claus is on the ACLU's hit list. They've associated him with enough religious content that they're going to go after him pretty soon, just like they are with the nativity scenes on schools and city halls. So I don't know. It's interesting because you're tempted to regard these things as sacred, and your tendency is to lash back at the people trying to get rid of them. But the fact is, these traditions, really none of them, or very few of them, are much more than a century and a half old. And we can get new traditions, too. What's really important, I think, for Christians to remember, one is don't get too worried because so many of our Christmas traditions have got pagan origins. They're pagan residuals of gracious, you know. Relax. Like I say, what God has cleansed, let no man call unclean. Once Jesus owns it, we can use whatever we want. And the fact is that really, our jumping up and down and protesting and getting really worked up probably is not going to be the mechanism that brings the Christmas spirit back in force. It's going to be people praying.
Hear, hear.
It's going to be people allowing the Holy Spirit to enter them in a big way, and another awakening, a freshening, if you will, another renewal. And I, you know, nothing dramatic in terms of outward manifestations. It's just people allowing the Spirit of God to control their lives. When that happens, I guarantee Christmas will not be stopped. The celebration of Christ's birth, the manifestation and incarnation of God in the flesh in this place is going to take first tier. It's going to be the thing everybody talks about. It's going to be the thing most celebrated. Just interesting the Lord has easily kept Christmas and its celebration alive through all the years. It's not likely to go away in the near future.
I don't think so. And Matt, I thank you for the good ideas. Now, I at the beginning of the program, before we got on the air, suggested that the whole red suit on Santa thing was from Coca-Cola. I've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
But you say no?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, they did. Coca-Cola was quick to co-opt Santa. He's a good selling thing. But this came from the 1822 poem by Clement Moore, an American Hebrew scholar, who just penned this little poem for his kids on Christmas Eve. Unfortunately for him, a house guest liked it so much, he copied it down and took it to the publisher. We've come to know this as The Night Before Christmas. And this is where we get Santa with the red suit as the jolly little elf that comes down the chimney. This is where we're introduced to the sleigh, the reindeer, the big bag of toys, all those wonderful things. All came from the 1822 thing. It's kind of a precursor even to the Victorian outpouring. Very interesting stuff.
Back when sugar plums was a real tasty treat, huh?
Absolutely. And I think a dramatic reading.
Well, I don't know if we have the time right now, but you know, we probably don't. I'd love to.
You'll have to do it on another program, bud.
Another program, but at 28 minutes here. It's interesting to note that the reindeer names, there's been some controversy on that, as Donner. Donner or Donder? Now, you know the right answer, but it'd be neat to get an audience poll right now. Is it on Comet, on Cupid, on Donner or Donder? And Blitzen, well, if you look at the last one there, Blitzen, which is, of course, German, lightning, guess what? Thunder is Dunder.
Is it really?
Yeah, so it's not, Donner is a pass in California and all the...
Now, this came from your awesome research department, didn't it?
Yes, one that has just been recently activated.
Is she still out there? Is she at the desk?
She's still out there. You know, good old Sue. You
God
ask
love
her.
Her
something,
it's
she's,
there.
She's like a dog with a sock.
She'll like that, I'm sure.
No, I mean, she's much more attractive, but I mean, you know, she'll just do it. Well, anyway, there you go. I should find some Christmas music here. Now all the hip... Wait.
And while you're doing that, on behalf of my absent partner and I, we would just like to wish everybody listening a wonderful and godly blessed Christmas.
All right. And with that, here is Brenda Lee. Thank you, Matt. Lord bless you, too, and our member in absentia here, Brenda Lee. Rock around that Christmas tree, folks.
Christmas party hop.